Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Frederick Law Olmsted is not exactly a household name in this country. He died more than a century ago. Nonetheless, he is widely credited with helping shape modern America. He was an early environmentalist who put that passion to work in his landscape designs. It is that design work for which he is most famous. He designed Central Park in New York City, the Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C., and numerous college campuses and even cemeteries. He was also a journalist, abolitionist, and conservationist. Plenty for a good biographer to dig into, and that's exactly what Justin Martin did in his biography, Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. Justin Martin joins us from New York. Justin, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You know, we talked before going on the air about the fact that Olmsted may be one of the most important figures that nobody has ever heard of. What drew you to him?
I was drawn – part of what drew me to him was living in New York City. Central Park was kind of my common yard as it was for so many people. And over time, I started to – at first, it was just a place I went to play Frisbee or went on a date. But over time, I started to learn more about its creators, Frederick Law Olmsted and his partner Calvert Vaux. And then the more I learned about Olmsted and learned about how multifaceted he was, the more I became interested in him and started to think, oh, as a biographer, he sounds like a rich subject to pursue.
Well, you must have really liked that park. As I understand it, you got married there.
I did. I got married in a structure called The Dairy. And The Dairy is kind of – it was once a dairy, of course. It's now an event space. And it was actually designed by Calvert Vaux, Olmsted's partner. And so it's a very, very beautiful building and a very nice venue for a wedding.
You know, you've written other books about big names, if you will, Alan Greenspan and Ralph Nader, significant people, needless to say, but not larger-than-life personalities, nor is Olmsted, terrifically talented, obviously. I'm just curious as to what it is about people like this that attract you.
I think what it is way back when I started on my Greenspan book, I was exposed to the idea that some of the most powerful people in our society, some of the most influential people in our society are not necessarily politicians. And I'm sure people note that there are just biography after biography of various political figures. And at the same time, there's kind of a short shrift given to some people that have pretty significant influence. I was in that capacity, I was especially interested in Ralph Nader. I mean, Ralph Nader accomplished more than any politician, including presidents, could dream. In fact, in 1972, he had the opportunity to be a McGovern's running mate, and he turned the job down because he said, I'd give up power. Of course, everyone knows Ralph Nader ultimately figured out how to kind of diminish his own power. But at the height of his game, he was an incredibly influential person, more powerful than most politicians. And likewise, I became intrigued by Olmsted because here's a person who literally shaped the landscape of America, not as a political figure, but in a different capacity.
You know, just to hang with Ralph Nader for a moment, many people may have forgotten the impact that he had on the 2000 election. It might have changed everything had he not been a candidate.
So very true. No, it's really become – at the time, of course, it was certainly an event that had many people, certainly people that were on the left, quite exercised. You know, Nader's continued involvement in the election, and then over time, of course, it's come to be more and more consequential. So yeah, that will go down as you know, Nader of course was involved in so many things for so many years, going really all the way back to 1965. But one thing he'll certainly be remembered for was his involvement in the 2000 election.
Well, 65, is that the year that he published Unsafe at Any Speed?
It is. Yeah. It was the year he published Unsafe at Any Speed, and of course that launched him into a crusade that you know has also just impacted everybody everywhere, basically.
Sure. Well, I've not read that book, but having chatted with you, I certainly will look for it now. Also on Greenspan, another certainly an interesting personality in these times. Let's get back to Frederick Law Olmsted. However, you say that he helped shape America. Be a little more specific as to what exactly you mean by that.
Sure. He helped shape it in a couple different ways. As a journalist, he traveled through the American South for the New York Times on the eve of the Civil War. And he provided at a time when there was real division, obviously, between the North and the South. And when a lot of people were reading books that were kind of polemical works about slavery, abolitionist works and so forth, Olmsted actually went on the ground and provided just incredible firsthand reporting from plantations where he talked to plantation owners and where he talked to slaves. And his reporting was really it gave people a real window into the institution of slavery. It was real on-the-ground reporting that also gave people an idea of the evils of slavery, not from a polemical standpoint but from a reported standpoint. So his reporting was incredibly important, and had he not gone on to the other things he did, he would certainly be a footnote in sort of the abolitionist struggles on the eve of the Civil War. Of course, as a landscape architect, he scattered his works, whether they be university campuses, parks, cemeteries, as you mentioned. They're scattered all over the country. He was also an early environmentalist, and he sort of got the ball rolling on the notion that that natural places really needed protection and preservation. So from that standpoint, he was involved in so many things that have really kind of rippled out all the way to the present.
Just to stay with the journalism aspect for a moment or two, as you point out in your book, it was particularly important, the things that he was writing pre-Civil War, particularly important overseas. Why?
Well, the reason it was is because when he had pitch-perfect timing. A collection of his New York Times dispatches were gathered together in a book called The Cotton Kingdom. And The Cotton Kingdom was published first in England in 1861. Interesting year to have its publication date be, but what that meant was his book came out in England right when the Civil War broke out. And when the Civil War broke out, England was very much on the fence. They weren't sure whether they would side with the South, which of course provided cotton to English industry, or whether they would side with the North. And it was really a kind of a divided issue for England. And Olmsted's book actually entered right into the debate. It became one of for those people who felt like England should not side with the South, and those included such people as Charles Dickens and Charles Darwin. They cited Olmsted's book as part of their evidence for why slavery was an evil institution. They felt they should not allow England to side with the South. So Olmsted his book kind of inserted into the public debate in England as the Civil War was beginning.
And as you say, had he done nothing else, he would have stood out historically for that work.
He certainly would. No, it would be – in fact, the historian Arthur Schlesinger once said that I'll be paraphrasing here, but he said that Olmsted's book really provided a window into a lost society, the best window into a lost society, the antebellum South.
How did he make the transition, and why did he make the transition from journalism to landscape design?
Well, he like so many people, he was the victim of an unfortunate economic event. It was called the Panic of 1857. It's a terrible, terrible downward spiral in economic conditions. And Olmsted lost his job in journalism. He was just kind of casting about for new work. And he ended up taking an incredibly – what felt like a modest job, a real come down for a man who'd achieved this high profile in journalism. He was called upon to clear a piece of land that was set aside for a future Central Park in New York City. His job was just to clear the land. His title was supervisor, and he was supposed to drain swamps and knock down old shanties and so forth just to prepare the land for someone else's design. And so that was a job that he kind of fell into due to need, because he'd been laid off basically.
But he had been close to the land as a child. The land was no stranger to him.
That's absolutely right. Although he'd had this long period as a journalist, he'd been raised in Connecticut, where one of his family's favorite things to do is they would take these horseback rides into the countryside outside Hartford, where he was born, and they would just ride in complete silence, just sort of enjoying reverentially the beautiful landscape. And then Olmsted spent many years, totally different career, before he became a journalist, as a farmer. So as you said, he was no stranger to the land.
Well, he was also a sailor. He sailed, at least.
That's right. Still another just to sort of put it in chronological order, before he kind of found his way to farming, he spent a year in which he took a sailing voyage to China as a very young man. It was not for him, basically. There were quite a few of his forebears had been seafaring Olmsteds. He found that he was more of a landlubber, but it was an important experience for him. He spent a year on board the ship traveling to and from China. And interestingly enough, he even took some of his observations from China, which he visited as such a young man. And he applied some things that he saw upon docking in China, later to his landscape architecture work.
Such as?
Well, the best example is for the Chicago World's Fair, a project he did 50 years after his sea voyage. He did that project in 1893, or he completed it in 1893. He was very insistent. He wanted to create these lagoons that would travel through the fairgrounds, and he wanted these little boats to travel over the lagoons. And he had just an incredibly vivid vision of what he wanted these boats to look like. He wanted them to be very small with real brightly colored awnings. And his vision was based on the Chinese sampans that he'd seen 50 years earlier. And when the Chicago Fair opened, and there were all these little Chinese sampan-looking boats traveling along the lagoons.
Well, you know, I've seen films taken at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904, and what you're describing as having happened in Chicago sounds a lot like what happened here.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because Olmsted, it is similar, and what happened is Forest Park, a large park in St. Louis, which certainly it actually Olmsted had nothing to do with it. I believe it was started in the 1870s. Well, for the World's Fair in 1904, they hired a man named George Kessler to redesign the park. And George Kessler was a student of Olmsted, or a protege of Olmsted. He'd written a huge number of letters early in his career asking for landscape architecture advice to Olmsted. And so when Kessler worked, including in Forest Park, preparing it for the World's Fair, when Kessler worked, he was always working in the vein of his mentor and the master Olmsted.
You know, we're very proud of Forest Park here in St. Louis, and we think that Central Park is a vest pocket park compared to Forest Park because it's 500 acres smaller.
No, it's true. Forest Park is a much, much larger park, and ultimately the way it was conceived with the additional work by Kessler, it has a lot of similar attributes as far as vistas, a real emphasis on nature. One of the things Kessler did was planted a large number of trees. Another of the things that Forest Park shares with Central Park is this notion that you want to have – Olmsted's idea was always to engineer, to have a lot of engineering applied and to create natural spaces such as Central Park that are actually more they're more natural than nature itself in a way. They've been very heavily engineered. Well, Kessler really took a page from Olmsted. For instance, he, in his redesign for Forest Park for the 1904 fair, he drained these swamps and he created, I believe, a series of five what look like natural lakes, but they're actually entirely engineered. So that was a very Olmstedian, creating spaces that are more natural than nature.
I want to pick up on that point and others when we come back. We have to take a break. My guest is Justin Martin. He's joining us from New York City. He is the author of Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, Abolitionist, Conservationist, Designer of Central Park. Back to continue our conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, I hope you know how to reach us by now, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email if you like at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We, of course, would take a tweet at STL on air. You can reach us also through Facebook. Back with Justin Martin in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Justin Martin, who is the author of Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, subtitled Abolitionist, Conservationist, Designer of Central Park. He joins us from New York City, not far from Central Park, I'm sure. Justin, you know, we're talking about two parks. We had mentioned Forest Park, of course, and we'll be spending more time talking about Central Park in New York City. At the time that these parks were created, 140, 150 years ago, there was plenty of land around. Why were parks so important and so desirable at this particular time?
Well, it's really fortunate that people like Olmsted were working in that era, because basically cities were starting to – they were filling out, and had green space not been set aside in the middle of cities, there's every possibility that certain cities like particularly Manhattan, which is an island, would have just filled in completely with buildings. So it was vital to have people design nice parks in the middle of cities to kind of alleviate the crowded conditions. This was a time when there were just immigrants pouring into the United States, and they were often crowded into tenements. So the parks provided a place for them to sort of almost experience country in the city. They were also places where people could kind of – Olmsted always was very much a reformer. He always conceived of these parks as kind of having a democratizing influence. So his idea, too, was that people, including new immigrants to America, would kind of mix and mingle in these parks, and it would be a kind of a democratic experiment where people would benefit from kind of bumping up against one another.
But, you know, Olmsted gets a lot of credit for Central Park, and we're talking design here. You really have to give some credit, and you do in your book, discuss it at some length. The politicians of the time, the people who were the decision makers, they're the ones that really got the ball rolling on this thing.
That is such an excellent point, because one thing that I was really struck by was very, very rarely did Olmsted ever suggest any landscape architecture project. Almost always, and the first park that he did, Central Park in New York City, is a great example. The second park he did, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and just about every other park he did, city forefathers who, or rather city politicians who had, you know, a vision that they wanted to create parks, they were the ones who did the appropriation, set aside the land. And then Olmsted was the one. I mean, I'm always very thankful that he was the one who was often called to design these parks, because his brilliant designs ensured that these would be kind of beautiful spaces that no one would say 5 years down the line. They wouldn't say, oh, that's kind of an ugly park that was created. So, hey, let's sell off half of it for development. And a few years later, let's sell off the other half for development. Because Olmsted did such a brilliant job of designing, these parks sustained, and they've continued all the way to the 21st century. But as you point out, it was actually really very forward-thinking politicians in cities all over the country during the 19th century thought, ah, let's set aside land now while there's still land in the middle of cities to be set aside.
Why would they have called upon him? I mean, he was relatively new at the game. What kind of a reputation did he have that he would have been selected to do the design?
Well, he actually had, in this particular area, he had no reputation whatsoever. The fortunate thing that happened was they announced a public – for Central Park, they announced a public design competition open to all comers. And at this point, Calvert Vaux, who was a trained architect, he sought out Olmsted to see if Olmsted wanted to be partners for the public design competition. And the reason that Vaux wanted to be partners with Olmsted was because Olmsted had this kind of this modest job clearing the land. And Vaux thought, oh, he probably knows the lay of the land very well. So if we're partners, he'll be able – you know, he really has an appreciation of the topography. But when they became partners, the thing that Vaux, a trained architect, had not counted on was that Olmsted, you know, from just being a kind of a Renaissance man, a man with a lot of ideas, he brought all kinds of notions to their design. They were a great partnership, and they trounced the competition in this design competition. There were 33 competitors. Olmsted and Vaux's design just – it stood out, just completely separate from the other 32. They won, and on the basis of that, winning the Central Park design, then executing that design, Olmsted then developed a reputation that he was able to use to create other designs all around the country.
But to the uninitiated, what would we look for in a park that would be part of the Olmsted Vaux concept that we would recognize and would stand out and be different?
Some of the things that you would look for, and some of them have, I'd have to say, have now become just – they're kind of part of the vocabulary of designing a park. But at the time, some of these ideas were a little bit more radical. And it's really – one of the biggest ideas is that a park should be a refuge of nature within a city. Believe it or not, at the time they designed Central Park, there were many of the many people felt that a park should actually be a celebration of sort of, oh, various, you know, a lot of statuary and triumphal arches. And there are even a lot of suggestions at the beginning of the design of Central Park that maybe Central Park should actually be a celebration of engineering aptitude. And so there should be – one suggestion was there should be a giant suspension bridge that people could enjoy walking on, and that would kind of give people an appreciation of you know, engineering ability. Well, Olmsted and Vaux had this idea, a park should be a refuge of nature in the middle of a city. As I said, it's so evident now that people don't even question it. But at the time, it was it was a topic that had to be debated. And in the context of that, some of their design attributes are, you know, a lack of straight lines. They loved, you know, curvature, whether it be pathways or meadows or what have you. Another real attribute is what I've described as just kind of more natural than nature. They were not averse at all to engineering a landscape and doing really very, very kind of interventionist things to create a lake or a meadow or what have you. And it would look natural, but they'd actually have designed it.
Yeah, that's something that I found most fascinating about the book, of how they worked so very, very hard of making things look natural, but they pushed a lot of dirt and rock around, didn't they, to get that effect?
They did. No, it was, Central Park was incredible, because part of the reason Central Park was selected as a site was because it was a very unattractive, difficult to develop piece of land. At that point, it was outside of the sort of the developed part of Manhattan. For anybody who's ever visited Central Park, it had these bursts of rock, what's called mica schist, coming up out of the ground. So it was going to be hard to build there. But it was also not a very attractive piece of land. And one thing that often shocks people is it was pretty much denuded of trees, because Manhattanites, if they wanted firewood or if they wanted for building materials, they would cut down whatever trees grew there. So Olmsted and Vaux, they oversaw the planting of hundreds of thousands of trees. What were once just kind of gross, low-lying, miry swamps, they turned into beautiful, what appeared to be natural lakes. So everywhere throughout the park, they took what was a kind of an unattractive piece of land, and they turned it into a natural wonder that's quite engineered.
And from the earliest days of the park, how long did it take, by the way, to complete that?
Sort of the main construction started in 1858. It was through about eight. It took about a decade till 1868, and of course, there's been work that's continued on it from that point on. But the bulk of the construction was completed in that first decade.
Well, the whole idea, as you've indicated, is to use the park as kind of a refuge, a relief area, a relief station, if you will, from people in the crowded city. Was it used that way? But was it used by the masses, if you will, or was it more or less a place for the elite to ride in horses and carriages?
Well, one of the wonderful things I encountered in my research, it was very much from its very inception a democratic space. And one of the very wise things that those city politicians came up with is they thought people have been debating and wanting a park for many, many years. So they said, let's not treat Central Park like something that has to be completely constructed and then have it open sort of debut after it's completely finished. People are not going to be patient with that. They said, let's open it up in stages. This is what the politicians of New York City said. And they wanted the very first thing in the winter of 1858, when the park was only a few months into construction, they wanted to take this man-made lake and they wanted to open it up for ice skating. And it opened on a Saturday in December. That was really the debut of this ice skating lake of 1858. That first Saturday, 300 people showed up. The next Saturday, 10,000 people showed up. The subsequent Saturdays, often more than 10,000 people showed up. And while researching the book, I read a lot of contemporaneous newspaper accounts of that lake opening up the ice skating. And those accounts describe how every kind of people from all over New York City, of every ethnicity and every economic background, were out mixing and mingling on the lake. So it really, from the very inception, the park kind of bore up the Olmsted and Vaux's democratic vision for it.
And I think you pointed out in the book that they were very, very sure to make the lake relatively shallow in case anybody fell through the ice.
Yeah, one of the funny things is the lake, I always think of it as almost like a bathtub. They designed it. It had pipes that would feed rainwater from other higher level places in the park into the lake. That would feed the lake. But they also had sluices that could be opened up, and they would drain water out into underwater springs that ultimately carry the water away. And they designed the lake so that in the winter for ice skating, they could lower the water level to 4 feet. So as you said, if someone were to fall through the ice, they presumably someone could pull them out. But in the summer, they would raise the water level up to 6 or 7 feet, and then it would be used for rowboating. So it was from the outset what looked like this natural lake was also actually a sort of a bathtub with pipes and sluices that would fill and empty it.
Well, once again, I see similarities to Forest Park. I mean, we have boating possibilities here, and we have a large ice skating rink, which even as we speak, I'm sure is very crowded right now because it's cold enough to skate, needless to say.
Great.
you pointed out a moment or two ago that parks of the time were generally considered places where people would be celebrated, personalities, politicians, military people would be celebrated in statues. But he hated statues.
He did. Olmsted's idea, if he'd had his way, a park would have been almost entirely a natural space with some pathways, for people to walk through and so forth. And he actually hated statues. But as you might imagine, particularly with Central Park, his first project, I mean, this was New York City. It's a big, boisterous city. People had many different opinions. And many people's thought was, particularly among immigrant groups, the thought was, oh, here's a venue for a park celebrating a national hero, whether it be for Scottish people, Burns, the great poet, or in the case of Germans, the very first statue in Central Park was a statue of a cultural hero, Schiller. And so as you might imagine from the very outset, even though Olmsted had his own vision in a boisterous place like New York City, there was an insistence that statues be added. And I personally, I love Central Park. I also think that Olmsted, he was a brilliant visionary, but sometimes he was wrong. And for my money, at least, I like having the statues there. But that's open to debate, of course.
Is Central Park the crown jewel of his resume, or would it be the Capitol grounds in D.C., or would it be either one of them?
Well, one of the really truly impressive things about Olmsted is there are a number of parks that could actually lay claim to being the crown jewel. One of the very nice things is that people that live in particular communities often really value these parks. There's a ferocious debate in New York City, ferocious, funny debate in New York City between whether Prospect Park in Brooklyn or Central Park in Manhattan is the finer Olmsted Park. And there are partisans. It's basically mostly based on where you live closer to where you've had enjoyable experiences. But the great thing with Olmsted was he always perceived that unlike, say, a Van Gogh or painters or other types of artists, they would feel like their works were finished and, sort of beyond meddling with. Whereas Olmsted always had this anxiety that if he didn't create a really beautiful park, that people would start to roll it back. They'd sell off the land or they'd introduce unpleasant and ugly elements into it. It caused him to be every park project he took on, he'd really think hard about making it a really beautiful park. As a consequence, although Central Park is very highly regarded, there is Cherokee Park in Louisville, there is Delaware Park in Buffalo, Prospect Park, as I mentioned, and a number of other parks and the Capitol grounds that are just stunning spaces. And that all grows out of Olmsted's feverish anxiety that a work that he did might be undone if he didn't do a really great job.
I want to talk more about the Capitol grounds in a moment, but because this program is in St. Louis, I'm looking for other St. Louis connections. And I know that he indirectly did have some involvement with at least part of the campus here at Washington University.
That's correct. The indirect connection is in 1895, Washington University, as I understand it, started looking for the original campus had gotten kind of crowded. So they started looking for a new site. And John Charles Olmsted, Olmsted's son or stepson rather, was involved in at this point, 1895. Olmsted had just retired; he was in very ill health. But his son helped with the siting, the new spot for what I believe is called the Danforth Campus, and he was also involved in much of the original design for the campus. And in doing that design, he drew on his father's campus designs, Olmsted Senior's campus designs, which includes Stanford University. So the original, the Danforth campus, kind of is executed by Olmsted's, or parts of the design can be credited to Olmsted's stepson, John Charles Olmsted. And one of the influences, or some of the influences, are his father's work, including Stanford.
I have heard this in the recent past, and it may be wrong, but I think part of that campus at Washington University at one time was called the Olmsted Campus. Does that sound right to you, or do you know?
I don't know, but it sounds altogether possible because in the early days, after John Charles Olmsted was involved in a lot of campus work, a lot of important campus work. That was a lot of what the Olmsted firm did after Frederick Law Olmsted retired and then ultimately passed away. And so I can imagine that at some point some of the work he'd done might be known as the Olmsted campus, because certainly the Olmsted firm as a successor firm to the father became very, very well known for its university work around the country.
Maybe we can get some help from our listeners on that. We have a call that I'd like to take now. Dennis is joining us from Overland while we're talking about politicians a little while ago. I think that's where he wants to go. Dennis, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, Don and Justin. As an aside, I was wondering, you can answer this later, I was wondering how much Teddy Roosevelt's, change of heart and things that he did made it easier for leaders to lead. But one of the things I just think it takes good leaders, but it also takes educated good followers as well. And sometimes you have to speak up, and that's up to us. And one other thing, my daughter lives in Guanajuato, and I would suggest to Justin, if he hasn't ever been there, it's in the 1500s when they were putting that city together, the city fathers and the people that had the money, the silver mine people, had the foresight to build so many parks and so many things that, I walk around that place and I'm thinking, who had the, whatever, to look into the future and do this? I'm glad they did, but I couldn't imagine how they got it through. But again, great show, Don, and you guys have a great new year.
Dennis, same to you. Thanks for calling. Anything you would care to respond to Dennis at all, Justin?
Well, I'd certainly like to visit Guanajuato, and then per the point that it's important to have. It is. It's really one of the very striking things is you have cities all over the country, whether it be St. Louis, Milwaukee, Buffalo, where it was very fortunate there was kind of this movement in the 19th century to set these parks aside, because if it wasn't done then, it would have been too late ultimately. So it was a very forward-thinking movement, and people all over the country can be thankful for it, because it really is one of the things that and another element that really kind of bore out, and it kind of bore out for Olmsted's democratic vision, is over the years, many of these what they ultimately became inner city parks. Milwaukee's a good example. That was on the outskirts of the city when Olmsted designed the parks. But by early into the 20th century, it had become the inner city. And so these parks became parks that were serving inner city neighborhoods where people didn't necessarily have a lot of other outlets or places to go. So it was great foresight that that these parks were designed when they were.
You're listening to Justin Martin, who is the author of Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, Abolitionist, Conservationist, Designer of Central Park, and many other things. We'll come back and continue our conversation. And again, if you want to get into it, please feel free to do so. What do you look for in an urban park? That might be an interesting discussion for what time we have left. Are you familiar with Olmsted's work, perhaps? And if so, what might be your favorite? We'll be back in just a moment with Justin Martin. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Justin Martin, author of Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. And we talked a moment ago, Justin, the issue was raised by Dennis and the role of politicians, and we've talked about it earlier. This is probably worthy of another entire discussion on a program like this. But you have to wonder if politicians today are as responsive to the kinds of needs that we've been talking about as were their forefathers a century and a half ago. It's an interesting thought.
You're absolutely right, and no, it's you do wonder. I mean, this was something you could almost describe it as it was optional creating parks, but it was recognized that this was good public policy, and of course, people could argue there are things that are far from optional right now that are demands or needs of the populace that are being ignored. So,
yeah, and the environment ranks right up there. I mean, there's not a consensus. Is there a political consensus at all on major issues affecting the environment today?
That's very true. And it's interesting because Olmsted, one of his main calls back in the 1850s was very prescient. He went out and he visited Yosemite. He thought Yosemite was incredibly beautiful, by one account at least, he was one of the very first 500 non-Native Americans ever to even visit Yosemite. So it gives you an idea of how isolated it was in this era. But one of Olmsted's first thoughts was something this beautiful way out in California at some point. In fact, Olmsted predicted that a million people a year would one day visit Yosemite. It seemed like a crazy thing to predict. And what did he suggest as the way to – he thought it was going to need to be preserved. And Olmsted felt that the government, the U.S. government, should step in and preserve beautiful places for posterity. This was, of course, almost half a century before the Park Service even existed. Mm-hmm. But also tells you – it speaks to a different era when there was a notion that the government might be a benevolent force that might step in and preserve something beautiful for posterity. So everything about Olmsted's particular call for preserving Yosemite is both prescient and also it reflects, it shows a kind of a different time when there was a belief that big things could be done by the government.
Right. That's part of the debate today, isn't it?
There's a sharp
division on that very subject. What about Niagara Falls? I mean, you're talking about a piece of property that Canada has some claim to, and yet Olmsted was active there. Was he not?
He sure was. In fact, his two of his great preservation projects where he was involved in Yosemite, early calls for preserving Yosemite, which was, as I described, an incredibly isolated place. He was also involved in the preservation of Niagara Falls, which you might even describe as one of the first examples of a beautiful place in America being kind of marred by Niagara Falls, of course, it's in the eastern part of the United States. It's relatively close to Buffalo, New York. By the 1870s, when he was involved in calling for the preservation of Niagara Falls, it had already become a popular vacation and honeymoon destination. All kinds of – there were big advertising posters that were up in the way of, you know, the falls. There were all kinds of tourist traps and flim-flam men and already the falls had been degraded as a natural wonder. And so completely the opposite of Yosemite, Olmsted's job at Niagara Falls was actually trying to undo what had already been done, trying to take this natural wonder that was being marred by advertising billboards and silly water rides and so forth, and roll that back. And so with a lot of work, and again, you know, in collaboration with governments and commissions and so forth, they managed to get rid of the things that were marring the falls before it was too late. And also they managed to create sort of discrete viewing areas. That was one of Olmsted's ideas. Let's have certain parts of the falls just be left natural, but let's have discrete viewing areas where everybody can enjoy the falls. And so that was also a very vital conservation project he was involved in.
I shudder to think in this modern day what those two places that you've just mentioned, Yosemite and Niagara Falls, could it be like if someone hadn't gotten someone like Olmsted hadn't gotten in and prevented it from happening?
So very true. Now, you read 19th century accounts of Niagara Falls and it sounds horrible. And you actually – it's kind of heartening to visit it today and see, oh, Olmsted's notion of uninterrupted vistas and a lack of – I mean, I know people bemoan that there's still too many – you look down at the falls. It's beautiful. You look up and you might see a hotel in the distance, but it's nothing compared to, you know, the kind of sort of over-commercialization that could have happened if wiser minds had not prevailed.
Do you think we are out of the business in this country of producing, creating urban parks? Is that era over and done with?
I have to say it's kind of heartening that no, it isn't. And there are a couple of different things that are being done. A great example in the city of Louisville, they're trying to create a 100-mile ring way out in the exurbs. And so one thing that's happening is the same model that once – I mean the middle of cities, it's a done deal. I mean you visit whether it be Manhattan or Milwaukee or what have you. It's, you know, there's not land to be had in the middle of a city anymore. But on the periphery, out in the suburbs and exurbs, there's a movement that continues to be afoot that, hey, let's set aside some land, as they're doing in Louisville, before it's filled in with strip malls, whatever it might be. The other really heartening trend is the repurposing of kind of decrepit industrial construction. And the very finest example of that comes to mind for me at least is the High Line in New York City, which is a park made out of an old – it was an old elevated railroad track that stood unused for, oh, probably 30 or 40 years, and it was repurposed as a very unique park. It's a railroad for people who haven't visited. It's a railroad trestle that you get up on and walk along. It's planted with various flowers and trees and so forth, and it's basically making use of a piece of industrial waste and turning it into a park.
Yeah, the problems that may develop along these lines, however, would be there is concern about the amount of tax increment financing that cities are doing for projects like this and others, and the fact that in today's economy, these kinds of things really have to be placed fairly far down on the list.
That's absolutely true. Now, one of the problems you see with both new park construction and also maintenance of existing parks is with budgets being slashed, priorities have to be assigned, and obviously parks are a tough, they're a tough thing to throw money into. In fact, a lot of places like Central Park, part of the reason Central Park's continued to look nice in a tough economy because so much of the money that goes to Central Park is private funding. And of course, that's also, people have less money to contribute as a charitable contribution. That also is going to hurt the upkeep and maintenance of these parks.
Well, same here in Forest Park. It was a private organization that really brought it back, revived it. It was never, outrageously decrepit or anything, but but it's been restored to just a wonderful presence now. We've had several tweets coming in during the course of our conversation, people saying their favorite thing to do is to run in Forest Park. How important were running or walking trails early on when it came time to design urban parks? I know in Central Park, being able to ride on horseback was an issue.
It sure was. Yeah, one of the things from the outset, one of the brilliant innovations of Central Park is called the separation of ways. And the original idea was that August Belmont, a name people might recognize, he was the man behind the Belmont Stakes, the one of the legs of the Triple Crown. He was
third
a big
leg
advocate.
Go ahead.
He was a big advocate of horse racing. Well, when Central Park was originally laid out, Olmsted, who is not a big equestrian, he'd done a lot of walking paths, but he hadn't done in Belmont. And Belmont was one of the commissioners of Central Park. Belmont felt not enough attention given to horseback riding, his pet hobby, and so Olmsted and Vaux had to go back to the drawing board, and they came up with this brilliant idea. It's called the separation of ways, where the walking paths wound through the park, and they wound over and under riding paths. And the idea was, if you're walking, you want to be able to kind of slip into a kind of a reverie. You don't want to suddenly have a big horse rear up in front of you. So they made sure that horses and humans never cross paths. Well, that convention has been applied to many, many parks, perhaps to Forest Park as well. And of course, what replaced the horse was the automobile. But in any good park design, there's an effort made to have this separation of ways where ideally in a park, there are overpasses and underpasses, whatever you might have, so that someone can kind of walk through the park and not have to cross a street, as it were. And at least in some of the finer park designs, they've held to the separation of ways.
I can think of other reasons why you wouldn't want to walk where the horses roam.
You hit the nail on the head. In fact, that Olmsted and Vaux actually commented specifically on avoiding that issue.
That issue. We have the issue here with geese, not horses, but geese. And there are plenty of them, and they make their presence known. Believe me, it's that can be a mess. I want to get back to the Capitol grounds because many people I know understand Central Park and have seen pictures of it. More, I think, are familiar with the Capitol grounds. What were the challenges for his design there? The Capitol building had to have already been there when he got on the scene.
The Capitol building was there, but this is one of Olmsted's most hard-fought projects. And the client in this case was Congress. And so Olmsted went head-to-head with Congress. Basically, this will give you an idea of how visionary he was, and also how he would often expand the parameters of a project. He designed the Capitol grounds, but one of his notions was, he said, I have created a beautiful landscape, but the Capitol building itself is unworthy of my landscape. And so he started battling for anybody who knows the Capitol building. In this era, it was this long, kind of skinny building. Olmsted started arguing that for it to be a beautiful building, it was just, he said, it was architecturally kind of out of whack. And what had happened is they'd been adding wings to accommodate the new members of Congress who came in with Texas statehood and some other states that had been brought into the Union. And so you had this long, skinny building. Olmsted said, you need to build a marble base around it, marble terraces, in order to make it feel substantial and grounded in the landscape. And of course, that required huge amount of money, huge appropriations back in the 1870s. But with a lot of fighting, Olmsted was both able to get his landscape design, but he was also able to convince them to change the Capitol building itself, to add these marble terraces, to make the building look properly substantial and grounded in Capitol Hill. And so even though Olmsted was a landscape architect, he actually became an architect to create a building worthy of his design.
The Capitol grounds, when we talk about that, are we talking about the mall itself as well?
The mall, actually, kind of like Washington University, the mall, we're actually talking about some brilliant work that was done by Frederick Law Olmsted's other son, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., serving on something called the Macmillan Commission at the beginning of the 20th century, along with the notable architect Daniel Burnham. Many of the elements of the mall were in place, such as the Washington Monument and so forth, but they came up with a really great plan that we're all familiar with now that kind of made it an integrated space that you could move through, and it made sense and was rational for a visitor.
One other area I want to touch upon in the time that we have left is the area of cemeteries. I suspect that not too many people give a whole lot of thought to the idea of cemetery design, but of course it would have to be very, very important.
It certainly is. And cemeteries, interestingly enough, they're sort of the forerunner of parks as we know them. In fact, before Central Park, people would often visit various famous Mount Auburn Cemetery in Boston or Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. And they would actually picnic in the shade of mausoleums and so forth because that was the green space that was available. But Olmsted was certainly – and that was something that he also lent his skills to, his designing cemeteries. And he's got a few beautiful ones around the country, including Mountain View Cemetery out in California, which is just an incredibly striking setting. Mountain View is, like its name, you're pretty up high, and you can actually see in the distance, you can see Oakland and San Francisco. So it's a pretty striking setting that Olmsted put a great deal of thought into.
I have an email here that I'm just receiving. Let me read it to you. We have about 3 minutes left. My great-great-grandfather was a German landscape gardener who came to St. Louis in 1870 to work on Forest Park and later Tower Grove Park. Prior to that, he was living in New York during the construction of Central Park and lived in the same ward north of the park as Olmsted did. I'm wondering if you are aware of any lists of Olmsted employees or associates, since it seems likely they may have worked together. They seem to be traveling in a lot of the same circles. I understand that German-style gardening was very influential in the design of parks in the 19th century.
Very interesting, and all he said and certainly German style gardening being an influence on Olmsted was certainly the case. As far as list of employees, sadly, I don't know that there's a list of the many, many people involved in Central Park. However, later the Olmsted firm in Brookline, Massachusetts, where Olmsted worked from the early 1880s on, they're their list of employees, employees of the firm. But Central Park, which was the biggest public works project in New York City at the time, as far as I know, I could be wrong about this, there's no list of the many, many people who are. And as you might imagine, a park, I mean, Olmsted, of course, and Vaux were the ones who designed it on paper. But it was the work of many people, including this gentleman's relative, to actually make the park. And furthermore, not only was it the work of many people, but as you might imagine, a natural landscape. I mean, there was a lot of latitude. Olmsted and Vaux had a design on paper, but it was necessary for people to improvise, as it were, when they encountered something different than and so ultimately, I guess, Central Park is a massive collaborative project.
The story of Frederick Olmsted ends with some irony. The fact that he spent, the last days of his life on a piece of property that – well, you tell the story. It was partially his design.
Sure. Well, one thing we didn't get into is Olmsted's sort of tumultuous mental states. He was a very often a very depressed person. And because of his mental problems, he loved designing the grounds of mental institutions. The reason he loved designing mental institution grounds was he thought he was a place where literally you could have a therapeutic landscape. The landscape itself could be contributing to the calm and peace of the people who are confined there. And in his own case, you know, he led a very tortured and tumultuous life. Well, late in his life, he started to show Late in his life, he actually was confined to a mental institution he'd early designed the grounds of, and on checking in, he reportedly said, "Confound them, they didn't follow my plan."
Well, you can get the full story from Justin Martin's book, Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. Justin, thanks so much for being with us. Certainly enjoyed
it. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
Wonderful book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about the good things that happened in the arts in the region during 2012. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at the people, places, and organizations for which 2012 was a good year. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.